supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hospital for the sickest of the sick.
The deal will save the city the more than $10 million it would have cost to replace the aging health clinic. Bochansky says the hospital wants to rehab the library and recreation facility on the same block if they can get the funding. The city hopes to open the new building in 3 years. I'm Carolyn Beeler, WHYY News.
In sports, a tough Friday for Philadelphia teams in the A-10 tournament. Temple, LaSalle, St. Joe's all lost. On the women's side, Drexel will play in the CAA semifinals today. They take on second-seeded James Madison at 2:30. Sixers beat the Jazz 104-91, and the Flyers are in Toronto tonight at 7. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, springtime is the best time to move plants around in your garden. And roses can take that move better than almost anything else you got out there. We'll explain how to move plants in general, how to move roses specifically, and also reveal why wintertime is the worst time to try to pick up your plants and get out of town. But mostly, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heap and helping of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, I'm calling you from Rosholt, Wisconsin.
Excellent, Scott. That's very good. I don't know where that is in Wisconsin, though. Can you pick us a corner of your state?
It's actually red. Dab in the center.
Okay, so that's where we'll decide to parachute in. What can we do for Scott in the center of Wisconsin?
Mike, I'm a heck of a cook. I can make anything. Chicken soup, anything. Can I make soil-free mix?
The answer is heck yes. And this cook did it for many years. And I'll tell you the recipe, Scott.
That's what I'm looking for.
What you mostly want to do is you want to start out with a big wheelbarrow or something similar to that that you can mix the ingredients in. You want to wear a dust mask because especially in their raw state, these ingredients can be dusty, and it's not a good idea to breathe in any level of dust. And then what you want to do is you want to buy one of those giant bricks of milled peat moss and the biggest bags you can find of perlite and vermiculite, and then you want a source of high-quality compost. And essentially combine them in equal ingredients. Now, you're in Wisconsin, so everyone you know must burn wood at some point during the winter, right?
Yes, I do.
Yes, so you have access to wood ashes.
Yes, sir.
The peat moss itself will be acidic. So when you buy a soil-free mix, the peat moss has had some lime, agricultural lime added to balance out the pH. You can do the same thing, but we're talking maybe an eighth of a cup of wood ashes per wheelbarrow load of soil-free mix. That's how little you need and how alkaline the ashes are. But what's interesting about adding the ashes instead of agricultural lime to balance the pH is the ashes actually have some real nice nutrients in them. And as long as you're not overwhelming the area with alkalinity, those nutrients will be released and they'll add to the nutrition level of your soil-free mix. So peat moss, perlite, everybody thinks they're little styrofoam balls in planting mixes and seed starting mixes, but they're actually a popped mineral. Vermiculite, which is a very similar, it doesn't come out in little circles, but it's another mined mineral that's popped in big ovens. I said peat moss, and then compost, about one quarter of each. Wet the mixture down with plain water as you go, because these ingredients will be very dry and dusty. And essentially, you want them to be dry and dusty because they're easy to haul around. I'm going to guess you can probably make twice the mix for the same amount of money as buying it pre-made.
I'm just astonished at the small amount of wood ash. A wheelbarrow, I should be able to put a 5-gallon pail of each of the four ingredients. So I have four 5-gallon pails of ingredients, and then 1/8 of a cup of wood ash.
Yeah, and I'm giving you as much wood ash as I can possibly allow my brain to do. I've done it on the tablespoon level.
Wow, my father dumps 10 5-gallon pails of wood ashes in his garden every year, and I can't teach him different.
Well, one of W.C. Field's three rules was you can't smarten up a chump. So, you know, what are you going to do? But you know better, and I think if you follow that mixture I gave you, you'll have fabulous soil-free mix. Just don't neglect the dust mask, and don't forget to keep wetting it down as you're working.
Okay, Mike, thank you again for your wealth of knowledge. You have a great day.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to share it. 1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. How are you?
Just fine.
And where is Sarah Fine, may I ask?
In Bath County, Virginia.
Bath County. Well, you must all be clean and sweet-smelling there. Where is where is Bath County? Virginia's a big state.
Bath County is in the western Virginia in the mountains. And I say Bath County instead of the name of a town because the towns are tiny and far between.
Okay. Okay. May I ask which mountains?
Allegheny.
Okay. Very good. What can we do for Sarah in the rugged mountain territory of Virginia?
I am going to be starting a new garden this year. We had a 60-year garden for many years that we put lots of compost in and everything else, lots of mulch, and got spoiled by, but we've built a new house and are now going to be digging a garden in an old cow pasture. How can we get this old cow pasture to give us some results in the first few years without depending on non-organic fertilizers and things like that?
Now, how recently were cows walking around in this pasture?
A couple of days ago.
Okay, so it's full of poop over the years.
It should be, yes.
Okay. Were it not full of poop, I would tell you probably just to build raised beds on top. But I'm guessing
okay.
That because cows have recycled the nutrients in there, presumably for many years, You got heirloom cow poop. I think we should till it up.
Okay.
And, you know, there is a danger with tilling. So, but of course you've tilled, right? And you live out in this area, you have access to the machinery and everything.
I think we're going to have to plow it, not till it, because it's pretty well compacted.
Right. Now we're just arguing terminology, plowing okay. And tilling. Tilling is the modern term, but when people talked about the dangers, they called it plowman's folly. Because you do release a lot of nutrients when you till or plow the soil. And you do uncover a lot of dormant weed seeds. How much of a garden do you want? Is this just for personal use?
Not huge. Maybe, you know, 25 by 40 feet, something like that.
Okay. I want to suggest you make one long row for the first year. 4 feet wide. And as long as you want it, you're going to be planting in a railroad car the first year.
Okay. All right.
No wider than 4 feet so that you can reach into the center from either side. You're going to till up the soil in this strip. You're not going to till up your walking lanes of 2 feet on either side. Then I want you to till up a strip on the other side of the walking lane. And I want you to take that soil from your unused strip, so to speak, and I want you to shovel it over on top of the soil you plowed up the first time so that you now have the soil from two lanes combined in one, and it should be raised up like 6 inches or a foot above ground.
Okay. Do we need to then put down some ties or something to keep it that way?
Well, not ties. I don't want you to use railroad ties. They're incredibly toxic. If you have some field stone or some old cinder blocks or pavers or maybe some down trees or you're willing to buy some non-toxic wood, that's fine. But then whatever you do, whether you frame it or unframe it, I want you to level it. And then I want you to water it, and I don't want you to plant anything in it that you want right away. And after 7 to 10 days, all the weeds that you uncovered and replanted will sprout. Just using a handheld garden hoe that you've sharpened, I want you to slice all those weeds off at the soil line. You now have what's called a stale seed bed. All the weeds that were going to germinate, or most of the weeds that were going to germinate, are up and you've killed them. So now you can plant in that bed. And then the following year, I want you to do the same thing in the second lane. This is kind of a variation on double digging. You'll make a third lane, and you'll fill up the second lane with that. And over time, you'll have this wonderful, like, truck patch of long lanes, but you only did the work of building one a year. So you put a little extra effort in into doing it right, starting out with a weed-free system, utilizing all that good cow manure, which is a well-balanced fertilizer, and then just add some compost to the surface of the soil throughout the growing season. And I expect you'll get most of a year's worth of growth, the first year's worth of growth, off of the fertility of the soil. It may be compacted, but there's nutrients in that there dirt.
Thank you very much.
All right, Sarah, thank you. Good luck. And go at least go visit your other garden. Plant flowers in it or something.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and start my first run of tomato seedlings. I've been doing this a long time, so I know not to cut corners. I'll use 100% soil-free mix, no dirt from the garden, real seed starting containers, not old egg cartons or other kindergarten stuff, and a heating mat, which, by the way, gets turned off as soon as the first sprouts appear. But don't go looking for all the seed starting details under S in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to move your plants around like dominoes in the spring. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
The Chester County Historical Society supports WHYY and presents their 30th annual Chester County Antique Show, Friday, March 16th through Sunday, March 18th at the Westtown School in Westchester. The show includes 60 exhibitors featuring 18th and 19th century American and continental furniture, rugs, jewelry, and decorative arts. For information on tickets, show hours, and sponsorship opportunities, 610-692-4800 or chestercohistorical.org.
Supporting WHYY, Oscilloscope Laboratories, We Need to Talk About Kevin. The award-winning psychological thriller starring Academy Award winner Tilda Swinton is now playing in Philadelphia and other select cities nationwide.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, springtime is one of the best times to move plants around in your garden. The plants are awaking from dormancy. They have the most strength and ability to recover from a move. And it's very important that you not try to have moved them during the dead of winter if your soil was frozen. We'll discuss moving plants, when to, when not to, when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Joan. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. And where is Joan fine?
Joan is fine in West Mount Airy.
Okay, very good. A suburb of Philadelphia, or is actually, are you in Philadelphia?
It's actually Philadelphia, but it's quite suburban and nice.
Yes, yes. All right, Joan, what can we do you for?
I have an immortal tomato.
Really?
I bought this tomato at the co-op in Weaver's Way about 3 months ago, and It never seemed to ripen. I put it on the windowsill with my other tomatoes, and all the other tomatoes have come and gone or rotted. And this particular tomato just never turned red and never looked good enough to eat. But it never rotted. It never looked bad either. So I decided to keep it and see how long it would live. After about 3 months, a couple days ago, I was eating something. I decided, okay, I'm going to try this tomato. And I cut it open, and it looked like it had been invaded by a fungus. It had all these little white strands running through it.
Right.
But when I looked more closely, it looked more like the tomato seeds have sprouted inside the tomato.
I think they did. So you mentioned Weaver's Way, which is one of the original food co-ops in Philadelphia. So they would not sell imported food at Weaver's Way. So at the end of the tomato growing season, they obviously brought in their full-size green tomatoes and sold them to people to ripen up at home, right?
That's possible.
Well, I mean, you did buy a green tomato from them, right?
It wasn't green. It was somewhat, it had a blush, or it was, you know, it was orange, but it wasn't fully ripe yet.
Oh, okay. Okay, but it was a locally grown tomato.
Yes, I'm sure it was locally grown.
Right.
So should I try to plant this thing?
That's a darn good question. All right, let's review. So you bought the tomato with a blush, and you kept it at home, hoping it would turn a deeper red.
Hoping it would ripen and seem like a tomato I would want to eat.
And you were going by color or feel?
Both.
Okay. And you mentioned you put it in a sunny windowsill?
No, it's kind of a shady area near the window.
Okay.
Near the windowsill.
Okay.
It's where I ripen everything. Most things ripen and do fine.
Okay, because, you know, there are a lot of people who think you should put a green tomato in a sunny windowsill, and all that does is ruin it.
Oh, no. I've grown tomatoes, and I wrap all the end-of-year tomatoes in newspaper and wait for them to ripen.
Okay, very good.
But this was not green. This was orange when I bought it.
Well, see, one of the things about heirloom tomatoes is some of them are orange when they're ripe. Some of them are green when they're ripe. Some are yellow when they're ripe, and quite a few are pink when they are ripe. And I have a fondness for the orange tomatoes that get streaked with red throughout them.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that this does happen, that a tomato is ripe. It doesn't appear ripe to the owner, so they keep it around. It starts to go bad inside. It starts to ferment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a secret that seed companies learned long ago. Because you know how when you open up a tomato, when you cut into it and you take out the seeds, they're encoded in this gelatinous mass.
Right.
That has to be fermented off. So whether you're a small-scale seed saver or a big company, you rinse out the tomato seeds in water. You let them sit in water for 3 days and keep stirring them. And then at the end of the 3 days, the water has fermented, and you can pour off the stinky water, rinse the seeds, and then they can be dried and saved. So your seeds got to the stage where the gelatinous mass had fermented, and then they sprouted. But because it was happening inside essentially a bad tomato, I don't think there's anything that could be done with the seeds. The other situation where I find this happens a lot is in bell peppers. Some of the seeds will sprout inside, and you'll have a baby bell pepper inside the regular bell pepper, which is very easy because bell peppers are hollow. But I suspect that your tomato might have been as ripe and tasty as a late season tomato could have been when it was fully colored up to its pink stage.
So I missed the good part.
Yeah, but it's one tomato, and you got to see this crazy thing. Matter of fact, you make me remember now, we got a letter when I was the editor of Organic Gardening where they cut it open just at the right time, and things hadn't gotten nasty, And as soon as they cut it open, the sprouts stuck out like bean sprouts, and they
right.
took pictures of it, and it looked like tendrils coming out of the center of this tomato.
Exactly. I was hoping it hadn't been invaded by aliens.
Yeah. Next time if you get something like this, what I do is I put the tomato that I want to ripen up quickest into a paper bag with a banana or a apple and let it sit there for a week, and then when the color looks good, that's probably as good as it's going to get.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. My pleasure, Joan. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Wayne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Wayne. How are you, sir?
Fine. I'm calling you from Central Massachusetts.
Excellent. Good man. What can we do for Wayne in Central MA?
Well, about 6 years ago, my wife and I actually bought a house about 8 years ago. And about 6 years ago, given, you know, new construction, we had a landscaper come in and plant, I think it was 5 6-foot Fraser firs in the back of our yard.
Christmas tree form.
Yep, exactly, as a screen against our neighbors. We like our neighbors a lot, but not quite that much. So we planted them in our backyard, and I was there when they planted them. They looked healthy, and no burlap or cage or anything like that around the root ball. They removed
Excellent.
It.
Good.
They didn't bury them too deep. They weren't too deep. I watched them bury it and made sure that the part of the trunk that actually meets the root ball was slightly above ground.
Oh, good. So you can see the root flare on the trees.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So far, so good, man.
Yep. They have a southern exposure, but my property borders some woods, and there is a maple tree that's probably about 12 inches in diameter that's relatively close to one of the trees. Well, let me back up. One of the trees looks to be dying. The very tip of the tree has gone brown, and at the bottom of the tree, some of the branches are dying off, and on the backside as well. There's a maple that's about 3 feet away from this particular tree, and there are all sorts of scrubby little trees that are growing in probably within 6 to 8 feet of this tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed this last fall, and over the winter, we've had a pretty rough winter up here, I noticed that the top of the tree, the very tip of the tree itself, has died away. And again, the bottom of the tree looks like I've got some dead branches on the bottom, and I'm just thinking to myself, is it possible, should I go in and clear away some of the scrubby growth, or is this tree a goner?
I would say it is a goner. The bottom branches is not unusual. Whenever you have an evergreen that's not full sun on all sides, it's a very natural occurrence for the bottom branches to kind of die off as they get shaded out by their own branches. In addition, and because these trees need an inordinate amount of sun, it's funny because I made a joke about it, you having a Christmas tree farm with Fraser firs. But that's Christmas tree farms are laid out very carefully to try to get sun on all sides of the trees. So if this tree was getting a lot of shade down low, the bottom branches doesn't surprise me at all. It's a natural occurrence. As the trees get huge, people just take off the bottom branches as they get ugly. The growing tip of a tree, that's the growing tip of a tree. Very rarely is that going to reverse itself. But it hasn't been dead up top for a full year?
No, in the fall it looked like it was starting to droop, and I was concerned then, but I figured, well, let's see what happens with the winter.
Is there any chance that there's bagworms on this thing, what look like pine cones but are actually a very clever form of caterpillar that builds a very nasty nest that looks a lot like a pine cone on a healthy tree?
I didn't notice any. Of course, you know, there's 4 feet of snow in the backyard, so it's kind of hard to get up close and personal with this tree right now. But I'll take a look.
Bagworms are one of the biggest pests of these trees. Of course, there's all sorts of imported pests attacking trees now. I like your suspicion, even though you haven't said it out loud, that this maple has sent out a root, a giant root that has strangled this one tree in the mix. I mean, even a serial killer takes out one person at a time. So, you know, maybe the maple just sent a root out here that made it impossible for this tree to get water and nutrients. What I would do is, yes, I would clear all the scrubby little trees away in the spring for good luck no matter what. I would. There's no wood mulch down around these trees, is there?
Oh, no, I never use it.
You've never fed them or anything?
I gave them, a couple of years ago, I gave them some Holytone.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an unusual choice. At least it's a natural fertilizer. I didn't realize that Fraser firs needed acidic soil like that, though.
Well, I had asked the local garden center, who's actually pretty good, and they suggested it. But I didn't give them a lot. I err on the side of underfeeding rather than overfeeding.
What I would do is spread a nice inch mulch of compost around all the trees and see if this one recovers. If you want to go for good luck and you don't mind doing some work, towards the maple, about halfway between the maple and the dying Fraser fir, dig down and trench down and see if you can find a big root, and then don't be afraid to sever it. You can cut if this is an enormous maple, cutting one root won't hurt it. So if you wanted to do this down and dirty, you would actually dig a trench in a line on the back end of these trees, in between these trees and the maple, and sever any roots that were coming over towards your Fraser fir. And then, yes, it's always good to keep down scrubby plants and other forms of competition. Probably very little you can do to improve the sunlight, so try to make sure they're not being strangled by the roots of other trees. Give them some compost. And who knows, there's always a chance if it's only been 1 year that one tree could come back. But if not, and it's really most sincerely dead, do a good diagnostic when you dig it up. Really examine the roots to see if it has been attacked by something. And if not, really examine the carcass for bagworm nests.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
All right, Wayne. Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Evelyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Evelyn. Where are you?
I'm in Glen Burnie, Maryland.
Oh, okay, just outside of Washington, D.C.
Yep.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you, Ev?
On a previous call, the woman asked about reclaiming a dog run in order to perhaps make a garden out of it. And I wasn't clear on what your answer was, but is that something that can be done? Because we have a dog, and more important than the garden, he's running around in the yard all the time, and my kids are also out there. And I wondered if you were trying to say that it is unsafe for that to happen.
No, it's not unsafe in the big picture of things. There are risks with dogs and cats in general. I mean, you've heard the advice, for instance, that pregnant women should never change kitty litter, should never go near a litter box, right?
No, but that's okay. I'm sure that sounds reasonable.
Yes, because all meat-eating animals that have soft feet are prone to having parasites. And parasites and worms have been found in indoor animals only. Now, the corollary is these parasites don't often transmit to human hosts, despite our proximity and the fact that every other person, I believe, in America has a dog or a cat or some combination of that. And you don't see outbreaks of these situations. When I remember that question, she didn't get into specifics. So this, to me, a dog run might be one dog. It might be 20 dogs. It might have been a reclaimed vet's office. So there is the possibility of worms and eggs and things like that, because the risk is skin contact with the soil. You pick up these microscopic eggs or something like that. You touch your eyes or you walk on it. The overall risk is really minimal, especially if your pets are seen by a vet and are basically healthy. But I do realize, because I have kind of barn cats that guard my garden against mice and voles and nasty things like that, that I really should never put my hands in the soil barehanded, which is why I spent so long on a search for the perfect tight-fitting gardening gloves so that I could wear gloves to protect my hands, especially as I get older. And, you know, by mid-season, if you're a gardener like us, your hands are all cut up.
Sure.
You know, so just wear gloves. But if you have a child outside running around on a lawn and the dog has regular vet visits, the risk is so close to zero you can see it from there. And one thing I want to make clear, one of the reasons I was warning her to, like, build raised beds on top, put cardboard on the soil, just kind of block off the soil to remove any risk, was she was going to work that soil heavily and grow food there. So all of a sudden, I'm thinking dog run. I don't know how many dogs. We're talking a lot of contact. I thought better not to ask a million questions and better to just tell her to do, you know, what's going to give her a better garden anyway, and that's to seal it off and build raised beds over top, because most people's soil isn't worth using for a garden. All right?
Yep, thank you.
All right, my pleasure. You take care.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and share a little seed starting tip I learned many years ago. After you've planted your seeds in soaking wet soil-free mix and covered those seeds with a bit more mix, sprinkle a layer of milled peat moss directly on top of all the cells. This peat contains natural antibiotics that can prevent disease. In this case, specifically the dreaded damping off disease that often rots new seedlings right at the base before you can start to back off on their watering. But don't you go rushing to rescue your arugula just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to move your plants around this coming season. I'm Movable Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
It's 11:38. This is WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. There's still time to catch the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show's tribute to the fine flora of the Hawaiian Islands. Today and tomorrow at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, 12th and Arch Streets. The Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College will hold a free screening of the Michael Pollan documentary, The Botany of Desire, this coming Friday, March 16th at 7 p.m. The annual Buck's Beautiful Garden and Home Show opens next Friday and runs through Sunday the 18th at Delaware Valley College in Doylestown. And I'll appear at the Radnor Memorial Library at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 21st, and at the Delaware Home Show in Dover on Saturday, March 24th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
The WHYY forecast for today, sunshine, but below average temperatures. The high only about 43. That doesn't last long. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. The high, 63.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in this stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. How and when to move plants around in your landscape, with a special emphasis on, but not limited to, moving roses around. You won't want to miss it. And you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing?
I'm doing good, Jeff. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I have a question about dwarf peaches in particular.
Okay, I have a question for Jeff first.
Yes.
Where are you?
Kemblesville, Pennsylvania. So right on the border between Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, right in that little corner.
Okay, very good. I can see you there in me mind's eye, and I grow peaches myself. So what do you need to know, Jeff?
Well, so I got three different peach trees. I have a yellow, a white, and I don't know if they call it bloodier, but it's sort of a reddish peach. And I got them, and I think they were 1 or 2 year old trees, and they grew up pretty high. And the scaffolding began growing, especially on two of them, almost at like 6 feet, like 5-6 feet, rather than, and all the reading I've been doing says that the scaffolding should begin between 36 and 48 inches.
By scaffolding, you mean secondary branches going out to the left and right?
Right, like sort of like a basket of branches where it starts branching.
And did you buy these at a local nursery? Did you mail order them?
I got them at a local nursery.
Okay, good. And you thought you were getting dwarf peach trees?
Yeah, and I can see the graft that's about 2 inches above the soil, but the trunk of the tree is not 3 feet tall. It's like 5-6 feet tall.
The problem with peaches is they have never been able to be as dwarfed successfully as apples have been. When I put in my wife's peaches, I probably got almost every different variety that you could get. So I planted probably 12 different varieties. Shockingly, three of them have stayed very manageable height, just the exact right height that you would want for a peach tree. Some of the others make oaks look like wimps. These trees can put on massive amounts of biomatter in a single season. It is just astounding. And the more they put on, the more flowers they produce in the spring, and then the more peaches. So, you know, they are a lot of work. Now, have you been pruning these in late winter?
I just put them in late summer last year, and so I read a bunch about pruning, but it's hard to find anything that talks about sort of training or establishing a height point. And if I follow the logic of what happens when they say topping is bad, topping causes a whole bunch of new growth and branching, which is exactly what I want.
I have never intentionally topped a peach tree. That is, I have never deliberately snapped off the top branch growing the tallest. That said, I've done it accidentally on three of the trees while I was trying to prune the darn things on shaky ladders, and those trees seem unharmed by it. And when I told my friend Lee Reich about it, because I was terrified, I didn't know they were going to recover, and I thought my wife was going to kill me. And he said, no, don't tell her you snapped off the top. Tell her you established a new central leader. Pruning is essential. I like to wait until the trees have flowered now because I enjoy the flowers so much. And then I prune them as the flowers are starting to fade. And every year, I think I take off too much. And then if somebody like Lee comes to visit me, he's going to go, when are you going to prune your peach trees? You know, so they put on so much growth. What I will tell you is you got to try to control the height. You
right.
got to try to keep the center open. Airflow is everything in these babies if you want to get good quality peaches. So as you're pruning, the first thing you want to take out is any branch sticking straight up right out of a secondary branch, because that's a water sprout, and it's not going to produce anything no matter what you do. And then some big branches that could successfully be easily bent, you might want to do a few of those. But yes, I mean, eventually you got to keep these things at even height, because I've got an orchard ladder, and I've been aggressive with two trees, and I still can't get to the top.
Yeah.
And after you're done pruning and after the tree flowers, you have to thin the peaches that appear until there's enough room for a peach in between every peach you leave behind. And that often involves taking over half or three quarters of the peaches off a tree so that there's enough room for the peaches to develop fully and avoid disease. And all of this requires that you be able to get at the sucker. I think you're smart. I think you can try to keep them at 6 feet. They're always going to produce lots of secondary growth. It's the biomass and the leaf matter that's going to keep the plant alive. And remember to keep the center open. And remember that they're work. You can't avoid the thinning. You have to take off most of the fruits to get fruit that you're going to want to eat as these trees get older. All right, Jeff?
Thank you so much.
Good luck, sir.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Sheila, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good, Sheila. How are you?
I'm well.
And where is Sheila well?
In Lansdale, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. Very good. What can we do you for?
One word. Thistle.
thistle is one of, like, the top three noxious weeds. It's thistle, running bamboo, and I don't know, maybe Japanese stilt grass or...
Well, let me tell you what we've tried so far.
Oh, I don't even want to hear it. Am I going to cry? Am I going to mourn?
Oh, you're going to cry.
No, I don't want to. I don't want to hear about your assaults of chemical herbicides that failed to do anything other than lower the frog and toad population.
Well, been there, done that. I mean, the other thing we did is we put heavy black plastic out to try to solarize it.
Did you kill
everything else but the thistle?
Sheila, did you read anything about how to solarize soil first?
I think my husband did.
Did he cut everything down to the ground, plow it all up
yes.
to bare earth and soak it?
I don't know about the soaking part of it, but the problem is we have like 30 boxwoods out there, coreopsis, catmint, daylilies, Russian sage, and now the thistle has decided to utilize those plants as a ladder.
Thistle doesn't climb, Sheila.
Well, I shouldn't say climb, but it grows like 3 feet high.
You did look up thistle. It does have a magnificent flower.
Yes, a purple flower.
Okay. So, and it's growing in flower beds?
Yes.
First thing I want you to do is now that we're in the off season, before the thistle starts growing again, I want you to go out to a big home center, garden center, and find a flame weeder.
Okay.
Now, your husband will use this gleefully. Any guy who tried to freehand soil solarization just can't wait to get his mitts on a flame weeder. And these are long metal wands. You screw a camp stove-sized propane bottle into one end. The ones I use have automatic ignition. You just click it on, and a flame comes out the business end. And so while you're standing up, you can wave the torch near unwanted plants and wither them. You can also just stand there and toast them to a crisp if you want, but you don't have to do that. So what I'm going to suggest is when the plants start growing again in the spring, you let the thistle show itself, so to speak. You let it get started. And you let it grow for about a month. When it starts to start developing a good number of leaves, the first time I want you to clip it off at ground level. Now, you know that won't stop it, but it won't make it happy. You let it grow for another like 2-3 weeks. And then when it starts to, the plants get to have some size, they're starting to put on a good number of leaves, you clip them off at ground level again. Now they're really unhappy with you. And then after that, every time you see something, because now you recognize thistle at all its growth stages, you and or your husband gets out there and torches it as soon as it puts on its first true leaves before it can start collecting any solar energy. Obviously, whatever you do, don't let any thistle go to flower again. I know they're really pretty, but once you let a thistle flower, you ensure that you will have much thistle the
now,
following year.
How do I torch this thistle without torching the boxwood?
What you do is you work in a team, and one person holds a very safe big piece of material, whether it's a heavy piece of wood or metal, wearing gloves, and they put it behind the thistle. The person flame weeding flames the thistle, and then the two of you move on to the next set of plants.
I'm going to give this a try because I'm tired of pulling out thistle.
Okay, well, good, Sheila. Don't get tired. Whatever you do, this is your summer to beat it. The flame weeder will work best when it's hot and dry out.
All right, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. This week's topic, moving plants, especially in cold weather. Sonia in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania starts us off. Mike, my rose bush is near the path to our garage, and it frequently catches our clothing and scratches our arms. It was planted there by the previous owners, but I think I have a better place for it, where it'll be out of the way but still get good sun. My question is, when and how should I move it? Perfect timing, Sonia, as the ideal window for such work is about to open. First, let me assure you that roses take being relocated as well or better than any similarly sized plant. When I was arranging and rearranging the front of our house, I used to move the poor things around like checkers. And as long as I picked their new spot correctly, that's an area that gets sun first thing in the morning and has good airflow all day, they never seemed to mind. Or die, which is especially good. Wait until you see their new growth appear this spring. Then prune the plant back as much as necessary to make the move less thornfully painful. Don't be shy. Roses can take a hard pruning in the spring, and all roses should be pruned in the spring to open up the interior of the plant and to remove any winter damaged or diseased sections. Now, you can carefully dig it up if you like, but I prefer to soak the soil for about an hour, pull on my heaviest leather gloves, and gently and slowly pull the entire plant up and out. Newly arrived bare root roses should always have their roots soaked in a bucket of water for a few hours before planting. And while this step isn't necessary when you're moving a rose, it sure wouldn't hurt. Anyway, dig a wide hole that isn't too deep. Place a cone-shaped mountain of high-quality yard waste compost in the bottom and spread the roots of the rose out over top the cone, like an octopus sitting on a rock. Otherwise, you should only fill the hole back up with the same soil you removed. Warning, warning! Do not bury your rose deeply or cover the stem with stupid shredded bark, stupid dyed wood, or any other stupid mulch. Many roses are grafted, and if you accidentally cover the graft, you'll give the rootstock, which may be the pestiferous multiflora rose, a chance to take over, which would be bad. And even roses that are grown on their own roots should be planted nice and high. It's just much better for the plants. Then mulch around your newly planted rose with an inch or two of compost. Again, no wood mulch and no mulch touching the stem, and then water it deeply. We move on to Stephanie in Clayton, Ohio, who wrote us in the middle of winter to say, "Hi. I'm moving 10 miles away in March and want to take some of my plants. I have lots of hostas, sage and lavender, black-eyed Susan, ornamental grasses, and bee balm. I'm generally comfortable moving plants around, but as I write this, we have 5 inches of snow, and I know the ground might still be frozen on moving day. What, if anything, can I move at this time of year? And how the heck do I do it? Well, Steph, first, you have to consider the legality. Do you have permission to take these plants? Because if you sold the home, that landscaping is included in the sale. And unless prior permission was given in writing, those plants must stay where they are. And even if you have a different arrangement, you should still avoid leaving a scorched earth look behind at the old place. Now, no matter what the deal, you, the soil, you, the plants, and especially you would suffer greatly if you tried to pull those poor puppies out of frozen ground. An uglier horticultural horror I can't imagine. And how would you even find the hostas? They have the good sense to be invisible right now. So wait, and if you are allowed to take the plants, come back and get them in the spring. The bee balm should be very easy to cut back and dig up. You can gently pull the black-eyed Susans out of soaking wet soil very easily early in the season, and the hostas will enjoy being dug up and divided soon after they reappear above ground. But, you know, it would probably be a visual crime to take the ornamental grasses, and probably the herbs as well, so I advise you to leave those behind and start some new ones at your new place. We conclude with Paula in Philadelphia, who writes, "Mike, it is mid-January as I write this. I'm leaving my boyfriend and moving to a new apartment. Can I hack into the frozen ground and dig up the root balls to take my prize garden plants with me? Or do I need to keep him on good terms at least until spring? And how would I even care for frozen plants?" I think we have a little bit of what's known as transference going on here, Paula. These poor plants are not your boyfriend. and it wouldn't be fair to take your new feelings for him out on them. Although I suspect your anger would dissipate greatly after 4 or 5 fruitless hours of trying to pickaxe your way through frozen clay. And again, if it's his house, you can't, or at least shouldn't, turn the front yard into the final scene from Caddyshack. So if you even have a new home for them, you said you're moving to an apartment, which implies the opposite, wait until spring, when all moods will be better. Well, that sure was some good information on how to move roses around and why winter is a good time to look at more TV instead of your garden, now wasn't it? Luckily, yous can read the print version of the question of the week at your leisure or even leisure at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to rip me out of frozen earth if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject of your email in the subject line. And please check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. We can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. His assistant, Sarah Kazar, rules the savage land. Our intern, Jessica Mandick, knows how to stay dormant over the winter. The always moving Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, is already in a perfect location. I'm Mike McGrath, and it doesn't matter where you plant me, as long as I can plant myself right back down here next week. Does a warm winter require you to make changes in your typical crabgrass prevention timing? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss when you should put your corn gluten down, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Tulips and tamarind, tarragon and tomatoes, spring is teasing, and Mike's time-honored antitoxin teaching will lead to intoxicating results in the garden. So join us at 11 Saturday mornings here on WHYY.
The Discover News Work.